the 40th, not 4th, but 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which has cost this nation somewhere between 55 and 60 million babies. And that's equivalent to the combined populations of both California and Texas, the two most populated states of the Union. Today is Sanctity of Life Sunday, and so I plan to talk about abortion. And in particular, I want to go over yet again, for those who may be new or even unclear a little bit, why we are to be involved in this battle and how to be involved. Also, you might remember that several weeks ago at the end of my series on homosexuality, I indicated that when this day would come, I would use the opportunity to also talk about our obligation to stand against the advancements of the gay movement, especially in their efforts to both legalize and normalize same-sex marriages. The two kind of go together, for many of the tactics and strategies in our efforts will be similar, as well as a similarity in the reasons to be engaged in these battles. And so, in a sense, today is kind of a continuation of the previous weeks. 2 weeks ago, I talked about matters pertaining to philosophy of ministry. Last week, matters pertaining to philosophy of teaching. Today, we could call it philosophy of cultural engagement, or at least somewhat. And though there are similarities in the battle for the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage, there are some differences as well, and so there'll be times I'll separate them out, and other times I'll join them together. Hopefully, it won't be too confusing. Originally, I thought I could juggle both in the same sermon, but once I got working on this, I soon realized that that plan was not very smart, kind of ambitious. And in fact, I rewrote this sermon several times and was still rewriting it last night and even this morning, up until 10 minutes till 10. So hopefully it won't be too rough. Because this is Sanctity of Life Sunday, and because I'd already done a recent series on homosexuality, most of what I will be dealing with today will concern the problem of abortion. That subject will get the preferential treatment. And though both are critical, I think we'd have to admit that stopping the useless slaughter of human life is certainly paramount. And as you will see, however, it will be easy enough to apply the same points to our efforts against same-sex marriages. These two battles are, of course, at the forefront of a cultural war that is raging in our beloved country. And though there are a few victories here and there that call for an occasional celebration, any long-term lasting victory on either of these is certainly a long way off, if such a victory were to ever come. This is a dark hour that we're living in. It calls for endurance and persistence and long-suffering, and especially humble dependence upon God. As many have said, we need to pace ourselves here for a very long marathon. It isn't a sprint where we can expect a short, intense burst and then a victory. Perseverance, faithfulness, patience, diligence. And those of us in this room may not make it to the finish line, but we must carry the baton faithfully nonetheless so as to pass it on to those who will come after us in hopes that they will make it, that they will see the much longed-for victory. Our efforts in this hour are no less critical than they were 10, 20, or 40 years ago, or what they will be 10, 20, or 40 years ago from now. It is. What we do is very critical. And though not everyone can serve in the infantry of this war, all of us have a place nonetheless, a vital role, each of us. No one who names the name of Christ is afforded an exemption from it. The burden, the duty, the obligation to stand up and fight for the weak and the oppressed is something we all share together as servants of Christ, as is our obligation to hold back the best we can the advancements being made against the most sacred of human institutions, marriage and the family unit. So let's start with that. What is our justification for political and social activism? Why should Christians even be involved? This is, as many of you know, quite a controversial question in churches today. It is hotly debated, even in conservative churches that would hold to a pro-life, pro-marriage conviction. This whole business of charging out into the public square, as it is called, does not enjoy widespread support. In fact, the current trend among evangelicals is to back away, not advance forward. In part, this is because it is now trendy to honor tolerance as the highest of virtues and to avoid anything that could be construed as contentious. Christians who are engaged or who are out there trying to make a difference are often accused by other believers of putting their faith in politics instead of God, of getting distracted with side issues rather than advancing the gospel, and even of turning unbelievers away with these combative social agendas instead of loving them into the kingdom. A pro-life pastor, friend of Scott Klusendorf's, a man who had personally raised funds for a crisis pregnancy center, said during the last election time when explaining to his congregation why he was voting for Obama, "While abortion is certainly wrong, I do not believe in single-issue voting. Neither do I see one sin as worse than all the others. When the church attempts to impose its morals on society, it only breeds resentment among unsaved people." This from supposedly a pro-life conservative. So what is going on? What kind of a hypnotic spell are these leaders of the church under these days when you read stuff like this? Scott gave a good answer to this, and it is one that helps to pinpoint the real issue here, something that continues to be a great source of confusion and frustration, and something I want to talk about this morning. I'll share just one paragraph. The rest is on our bulletin board. He says, "Is promoting legal protection for unborn humans an example of imposing views on society? I don't think pro-life Christians are imposing their views any more than abolitionist Christians were imposing theirs or the Reverend King was imposing his. Rather, they were proposing them in hopes that their fellow citizens will vote them into law. This is how a constitutional republic like ours works. We are not looking to establish a theocracy that we impose on non-Christians, only a more just society for the weakest members of the human family." And that's exactly right. That's exactly what the issue is here. And we can't forget that. We must be ever so careful to not get knocked off course by the straw man argument we hear all the time, and now hearing it even from Christians themselves, that this is all about controlling others and imposing our brand of morality on the laws of this nation and forcing the populace to become legalistic, narrow-minded, unhappy, religious zealots like ourselves. That's not it. The issue here is whether or not God's people will stand up and fight for those who are being unjustly sentenced to death without any advocate whatsoever. The issue is here is whether God's people will give their consent to the slaughter of human beings by stepping aside. And so, you know, we're just seriously just getting weary of hearing how abortion is a political issue and that we should just preach the gospel. This is far more than a political issue. It is a gospel issue. It is a loving yourself as your neighbor issue. It is a taking up the cross and following Jesus issue, of obeying his commands and honoring his gospel in the fullest sense. And so, yes, we are moved out of deep convictions grounded in the truths of God's word. But our motivation to engage our culture is not because we're trying to force our convictions, our interpretations of scriptures on others, but because innocent people suffer unjustly when righteousness is restrained and evil runs unchecked. We want a just society that protects its weakest members, a just society that preserves the family unit. And so, this is why we must be political and social activists, diligently fighting for the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. Again, if we don't, the weak and innocent will be victimized. And if we can help those in need and don't, if we step aside, well, God's word is quite clear about how that will fare on Judgment Day. Just read Matthew 25. Another challenge we face when it comes to justification, to the justification of entering into the fray, deals with the questionable use of time and resources and all the apparent inconsistencies that go with that, which are faithfully brought up over and over and over and over again, and it too comes from both abortion supporters and mindless Christians. In response to this, Scott Klusendorf wrote up a little parable of sorts and posted it on his Facebook page. Many of you may remember it about a month ago or so. Apparently, he was being hammered at that time along these lines and needed to vent a little bit. And here's what he wrote. Joe found the girl unconscious in her upstairs closet. By the time he got there, the structure was a raging inferno. No one else dared go inside. Scooping the girl up, he took his only exit straight out the second-story window and into the bushes below. Joe broke the fall with his legs, and the girl lived. For his part, Joe sustained 3 cuts and 2 sprained ankles and an avalanche of questions. The media wanted to know how he planned to pay for the girl's food, clothing, and health care now that he'd rescued her. The evangelical pastor asked if the time spent saving the girl from temporal flames might be better spent saving people from eternal ones. The social justice leader of the Catholic parish insisted that if Joe truly cared about saving lives, he'd care about all life and spend equal time rescuing poor workers from corrupt corporations. The local congressman asked if he supported tax hikes to support federal programs aimed at reducing fire risk. Joe just kept looking at the girl. So the next time you hear some of this nuttiness that fighting abortion is an irresponsible distraction, this parable would be a good one to refer to. It has been my experience that those who think along those lines have simply failed to come to grips with the full humanity and personhood of the unborn child. And that is why we must always be clear. The reason Christians are obligated to fight this fight is all about loving one's neighbor and not about forcing Christian morals or advancing a political conservative agenda. Well, a lot more could be said about all this, but I probably don't need to, given that I'm pretty much preaching to the choir here this morning. So let's move on to a couple big questions that I do want to deal with here. First, what is the best way to actually frame our argument to our culture in the public square against abortion and against homosexual marriages? And secondly, what is the best way to advance that argument? And each of those questions are huge, could take weeks to adequately address, and even then I would expect it'd be difficult to get everyone here to see eye to eye on everything, especially when it comes to tactics and strategies. And so all I want to do this morning is offer some basics, and the points I will cover more or less represent my best understanding of those particular points at this time. And so this is not a thus saith the Lord kind of thing. And I'll let you decide whether what I propose or not holds water. When it comes to framing the argument, I think that on a strategic level, our approach to homosexuality should be a bit different than our approach to abortion. Let me explain. There is still a general consensus in our land that killing another human being for the purpose of convenience is morally objectionable. I'm not sure how long that consensus will be around, but it is something we should take advantage of while we can. And so with abortion, the task is generally that of simply connecting the obvious dots. The fetus in the womb is human. Killing humans is wrong. The contention, as you know, is over the question of whether the fetus is truly human or not, a person. And to help with that, there are, of course, countless resources available. But the truth is on our side here. Science is our greatest friend. And this is why our kids go to the Friends for Life camp each summer, and it is what Scott and Michael do every day. And, you know, they train others, especially college kids, to make that case and to make it logically and persuasively. Think again of the SLED argument, you know, the acronym SLED. You're all aware of that, correct? Okay, I have to admit at the moment I can't exactly recall how all that works, but I know that it's a good one, and I know where to get it if I need it, but... I got the old age thing going here. Josh, how does that go again? Where's Josh? I know you know it.
Level of development, environment, and dependency.
Very good. Here, come on up. Take the rest of this. All right. But when it comes to abortion, the moral argument works in our favor. People are generally agreeable to the idea that we just can't kill anyone we want to. And I believe that is what we need to keep hammering, one-on-one with others and in the public square itself. However, when it comes to homosexuality, there's not as much of a consensus on the underlying moral question there. Here we are dealing with matters pertaining to sexual freedom, and that's a completely different ballgame. Even if most people are personally uneasy with same-sex unions, which is probably the case, they don't want anyone, the church or the government, telling others what they can or can't do with their love lives. And so moral arguments are going to meet resistance and not be all that effective. That is, in the public square. When it comes to one-on-one conversations with non-believers, settings where we can take the time to do it right, so to speak, then by all means, the moral argument is the way to go, especially if you use questions to expose the flaws of one's position, as we explained several weeks ago when we talked about all this. But that's a different situation, not the kind of setting we are talking about this morning. Today, everything is about the public square, engaging the culture at large. What we write in a letter to the editor, or what we post on a Facebook page, what we say to the news media at a demonstration outside the courthouse, and so on. Even what kind of an argument we would make when appealing to a congressman to support or oppose a bill that he will be voting on. In settings like this, we don't have the time, we don't really have the opportunity to work out a comprehensive and persuasive moral argument that well, given that there's just not that much common agreement on matters of sexual freedom. And so when it comes to homosexuality in the public square, I think it is best to keep the argument focused on the practical elements. We talked about these during the series. One approach is to raise concerns about public health. Among practicing homosexuals, we find an increased rate of STDs, depression, alcohol and drug abuse, sexual addiction, AIDS, suicide, and so on. These facts are not disputed. They're readily available. Our communities will at least be somewhat receptive to the argument. Certainly, we must be hesitant to enthusiastically promote a lifestyle that puts people in harm's way. I think that's a good argument to advance in the public square. Another approach is to talk about the common good for society. Studies show that monogamous, heterosexual marriages are the best environments for raising children. The health and strength of the family unit is fundamental to a health and strong society, to a healthy and strong society. Again, resources that address this are readily available. The facts speak for themselves. Another point that can be effective is to talk about the legal and social fallout of legalizing same-sex marriage. Once the standard of a one-man, one-woman marriage is broken, there's no logical stopping point. Polygamists, as you know, are already standing in line, waiting to be next. Upon what grounds could we deny even practices like incest? Or what's to prevent marriage between humans and animals? Giving non-marital relationships the same status as marriage does not expand the definition of marriage. It destroys it. And then that is forced upon everyone else. Is that fair? I think that's a good argument to make as well. Well, each of these could be effective, and I think it would serve us well to be somewhat equipped in them. The objective is to show the practical advantages of heterosexuality and the practical disadvantages of homosexuality. So again, just to kind of summarize this, when it comes to framing the argument against abortion for the public square, I think it best to present a case on the immorality of killing innocent human beings. When it comes to framing the argument against homosexual marriages for the public square, I would argue that it's best to take a more pragmatic approach, namely, this is bad for society. What I would avoid, some of you are not going to like this, but what I would avoid in both issues in the public square is appealing to Bible verses, quoting scripture to either condemn homosexuality or abortion. Doing so generally works against our case, not for it. Not that it is wrong to quote scripture, it is just bad strategically. Because the fact is, I mean, we're not living 50, 60 years ago. The fact is, right now, in this age, in this culture, scripture doesn't carry any weight with non-believers. It means nothing to them. We might as well be quoting Peter Pan. Really, I mean, the Journal Gazette loves to print letters that are drenched in Bible verses. They love it. To them, and unfortunately to many of their readers, such letters serve as the same purpose as the comics. They're entertaining to read, but no one ever takes them seriously. So, don't throw pearls before swine. Think Colossians 4:4, where Paul exhorts us to be wise in the way we interact with outsiders. Be strategic. Don't blow the opportunity. So whatever the setting is, again, in the public square, you know, I would encourage you to appeal to something that will ring true with the population at large. Either a common value that we as a culture embrace, like justice for the weak and oppressed, or a pragmatic concern. We all want what is good for society. All right, let's now move on and talk about the various ways, tangible ways we can advance our case, methods for getting the message out there. And on this, I'm going to focus primarily on the war against the unborn. But again, it will be easy to apply all this to the war against marriage as well. The thing that always comes to mind when I think about this are these familiar words from Jesus: to whom much is given, much is expected. And so the question is, what have we been given? Well, we have all been given a lot. Everyone in this room has been given a lot. Let's talk about money. Obvious one, big one. If we believe abortion is murder, we should act like it, including the way we spend our money, as in supporting pro-life ministries that are doing what we aren't able to do. You know the words, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There's a lot there to be said for that. Another resource we have been blessed with is time. The same points apply. Think about what you have done this past year. How much time have you devoted to being an advocate for the victims of abortion? Too busy for the March for Life once a year? Too busy to pray for babies scheduled to be killed on Thursdays? How much time does that take? But too busy? Is this conviction you confess that something should be done to stop the killing backed up by what you do with your money and with your time? What else have we been given? Well, in this room and millions of others who live between the borders of Canada and Mexico, we have been given a constitutional republic, the right to vote, the right to assemble, freedom of speech, and so on. These are rights, tools, resources, opportunities that citizens in many other nations do not have. Do we not have an obligation to use such rights to change laws and public policy and to influence our nation so that we might become a more just society for the weakest members of our human family? Or are these rights just there for our own personal benefit, to be exploited for our own selfish needs and ambitions? Or I could go on with more, outlining a number of ways we can and should be involved, but you pretty well know what they are, and you've heard them a number of times. Currently, there doesn't appear to be one particular strategy that rises or method that rises above all the others. This is a constant slugging it out day by day in a long, persistent effort, employing a number of different strategies, a number of different methods across the board. And things are, quite frankly, a bit stymied at the moment, as Denny put it last Wednesday in the office. I mean, we need a new strategy. We need some bursting through the gates kind of thing that will help energize the troops and rally those who have not been involved. Something that will drive this ugly industry back to hell where it came from. And we should be praying along those lines, a new idea, new approach. But right now, until that comes, it's a matter of staying at it on multiple fronts, faithfully, diligently, patiently. And so on that note, let me change direction here a little bit and talk about our own church for a moment. What we are doing and what we aren't doing and what we should be doing or doing more of, and perhaps the place to start is to provide a little historical context and talk about what we used to do. And for those who are newer to our church, what I'm about to share will hopefully prove to be helpful, because it can kind of explain some things about us. So let's do a little church history here, going all the way back to 1993, 20 years ago. It's really deep church history. All right. Back 20 years ago, when Michael and Lon were planning out what this church would look like once it was up and running, though they had a number of driving convictions that fueled their vision for Church of the Lamb, our original name, pro-life activism was certainly at the top of that list. This was going to be a church that would not shy away from a visible and active role in the battle for the unborn. And that conviction was shared by all the charter families and was, in large part, a huge drawing card for those who came into this body during the early years, some of whom are still with us today. In fact, I'd like to see the hands of those who started coming to this church within the first two or three years of its formation. Okay, number of folks. All right, good. Though I was not a part of the church at that particular time, I was, because of my relationships with Michael and Lon and many of the other original families, keenly aware of these convictions and plans. Whenever there was a pro-life event, be it a rally or a protest or whatever, this church was out there in full force. Many were at the abortion clinic each Thursday when it was still there on Webster Street. Many in this church served as sidewalk counselors. Many participated in something called rescues and were arrested. Michael often gave sermons condemning both abortion and the apathy toward it that Christians had, and called upon members to make stiff sacrifices in order to be a voice for the voiceless, to be salt and light in our culture. And so pro-life activism, for those of you who have started to become a part of our church in recent years, pro-life activism is a part of our DNA. It runs in our blood. It runs deep in my blood as well. Some of you may know of my own history in this battle. Some of you probably don't, but this was back in the 80s and early 90s. I drove my first church crazy. I did. I just drove them crazy with my pro-life activism and endless sermons on abortion. Eventually, in their interest and in mine as well, I moved on. And I helped to start and then lead an organization called Northeast Indiana Rescue. I organized demonstrations, life chains, boycotts, protests, even protests in front of the homes of abortionists, and a number of rescues at the abortion clinic here in Fort Wayne and elsewhere, like Toledo, South Bend, Niles, Michigan, and helped with a number of national rescues as well. So I have kind of a radical past in this area. Rescues, for those who may be too young to remember them, were basically sit-ins at abortion clinics, blockades involving hundreds of people, which caused them to close down for the day. And they were called rescues because if the clinic couldn't open up for business, then babies were saved, at least given another chance. And sometimes abortion-minded women would change their minds. Unfortunately, these particular types of activities were considered illegal, something about trespassing, and we were usually arrested. Sometimes we sat in jail. Sometimes we paid fines. Sometimes we were sued by the abortion clinic. I was almost always sued. During those years, I was on a first-name basis with the local chief of police, the sheriff, the prosecutor, and the head of the federal marshals, all right? Mostly in a good way, but we were all on first-name basis, saw each other a lot. Those were eventful days, the stress of which I do not miss. Jail was easier than dealing with lawsuits, and lawsuits were easier than managing pro-life activists. I loved everyone dearly, but they could be quite a handful at times, and someday I may tell some of the stories. But it kind of helps to explain, at least in part, some of the reason that I tend to be fussy and grouchy and intense with all of you. It's lingering psychological damage from those days of battle. But my point is, this church has a deep history in political activism and cultural engagement, as do I and many, many others here as well. In fact, raise your hand if you had ever participated in a rescue. Let's just see everybody who's look at this. A lot of people here. That was a long time ago, right? How about sidewalk counselors? Raise your hand if you ever served as a sidewalk counselor. Raise them high. Very good. Excellent. Raise your hand if I've ever been grouchy with you at any time, right? No, I've not been that grouchy with that many people. So for our newer folks, we are a church made up of pro-life activists. That's our heritage. We were forged in the fires of radical frontline activism. But there's been a bit of a shift, a gradual shift during the past 10 years. The frontline activism is not in our church what it once was. There have been moments like the protest Seth organized with the youth 4 years ago against Obama's campaign. But overall, things have kind of cooled down. That is on what we generally think of as frontline activism. There are several reasons for this. I won't get into all of them. Some valid, some not so much. And so I want to take a few minutes to address this, a little bit of this, if you would just bear with me. And there's kind of a point to all of it eventually. First, it is important to point out that the shift hasn't been from more pro-life to less pro-life, but a shift in the types of pro-life efforts we have been as a church engaged in and supporting. 10, 15, 20 years ago, we were all about fighting this war on the battlefront itself. Protests, demonstrations at the clinic, rescues, life chains, so on. We really didn't do much when it came to training our youth, or giving financial support to pro-life ministries, or for that matter, even praying on a regular basis. It is somewhat like the war on poverty. Remember what we discussed when we went through all that a while back? There are other ways besides just offering immediate relief. The effort also requires long-term programs of rehabilitation and development. One approach is not more important than the others. They are all needed. And each church has to evaluate its own resources and abilities and even availability and decide which one it can best devote itself to. And the same is true with the war on abortion. You know, training members of our youth group, on how to make a compelling pro-life argument in their speech class is just as valuable as persuading a woman walking into the clinic on Thursday morning to cancel her appointment. Who knows how many kids in those classes who hear these speeches will one day face a life-death decision. Think of the women being grounded in a Christian pro-life worldview at a friend's house. How many of them, if ever faced with an unwanted pregnancy, will now choose life? Made possible because we, along with others, have kept that ministry going with both our finances and our people. Think of the thousands of college-age kids being trained as pro-life apologists under the ministries of Scott and Michael, whom we support. What about all the college kids who have changed their minds after seeing the disturbing pictures Seth and Jamie display on campuses around the country, and the endless discussions and the countless discussions that those opportunities provide? And the Women's Care Center is another, located right there next to the abortion clinic. I mean, what an opportunity. Only God knows, and truly, only God knows how many abortions have been prevented, babies who have lived, because of those investments we have made as a church, including our faithful prayers every Sunday morning. This is not to suggest that there's no place for frontline activism. It is, however, to suggest that contrary to much of what I used to convey in my own sermons at rallies long ago, frontline activism is not the only place this battle is to be fought, and is certainly not a measurement of one's pro-life conviction. While we are a long way off from winning this war, it is true that the rate of abortions each year is decreasing. This says something about all of these other efforts that work more from behind the scenes. They are bearing fruit. There is success here on a small level, but there is. You know, for instance, when I was leading protests and marches at the clinic each Thursday in the early 90s, we could expect 30 to 40 abortions each morning. Last Thursday, it was 6, which I understand is a typical number these days. Again, the important thing is that we keep plugging away, which we are doing. We pray for the babies every Sunday, and that our president would become more pro-life, or that he would become pro-life. We support pro-life ministries generously. Most of our missions budget funds pro-life ministries. We call people to attend events like the March for Life and have a good representation there each year. We exhort our folks to pray for pro-life candidates, and I assume that everyone does, to vote for pro-life, and I assume that everyone does. And we train our kids to be pro-life apologists, and on. Again, I would maintain that we are not less pro-life than we used to be. It's just that we have gradually shifted away. We have gradually shifted the way in which we are involved. A second reason we are not as involved on the front lines of the battle, like at the clinic itself, is because of questions of effectiveness. And not everyone will agree with me on this, and I may be all wet here, but just hear me out anyway. The setting on Inwood Drive, where the clinic is now located, is just not the same kind of setting that we had on Webster Street. When the clinic was downtown, sidewalk counselors could actually talk to the women going in. Now, they drive into a private parking lot and go right into the clinic, and to talk to them requires one to yell at them. Also, there aren't any public sidewalks. The road's busy, many who drive by are a bit hostile, and so it isn't a place that works well for moms with kids, unlike Webster Street, which did. If the reason to be there is to pray, one can pray from home or work. The efficacy of a prayer does not require a certain geographical location or day of the week. If the issue is to maintain a presence, a visible opposition to what is going on in there, well, that certainly has merit. But the location has low visibility, and each time I've been there, there have been plenty of folks present, some of sound mind, some who aren't quite as much so. It's a zoo, often. But I do wonder about just how effective the whole thing is, and I do believe that that's a legitimate question. But if for no other reason than to make a statement, we oppose the slaughter of innocent babies, we oppose what's going on in that building, then that itself is enough reason to go there, at least some. And perhaps the time has come to set aside a few Thursdays each year, as we once did, and make a concentrated effort to call our folks down there as a church body. And so if we were to do something like this, who would be inclined to come? All right. Excellent. Very good. We'll try for something here probably in March as our first one. Another reason we aren't as active at the clinic as we once were is because of me. I remember Ted telling me years ago when we were trying to recruit churches into this battle, things fly or die according to the pastor, he said. The pastor is the key. And as you know, I haven't pushed it. I haven't been down there much myself. I've had mixed feelings about the whole thing. Some of the factors I shared previously play into this. And the truth is, I've scaled back in many areas of my involvement in this battle, not just in the frontline activism stuff. And unfortunately, I've gotten comfortable in that. I find myself condemned by my own sermons I gave in churches at rallies 20 years ago. I have to force myself to go to the March for Life each year because, it's the right thing to do. That's why I go. I see the value of supporting these efforts where the troops can be reminded of the importance of this battle. It's an opportunity for hundreds of people to say to our community with one voice, we oppose the killing. But I have no burning desire to go, no passion. I'd much rather stay home. I probably still got some battle fatigue issues going on. I'm just going to be real transparent here with you. I am tired of pro-life rallies. I don't like pro-life rallies. I'm tired of pro-life speeches, pro-life songs, pro-life testimonies, pro-life newsletters, and pro-life banquets and everything else. I appreciate the efforts. I love it that people are out there doing what needs to be done. But after having lived solely on that diet for many years, I'm burned out on it. And it's no doubt the result of running a sprint hard and fast for too many longs instead of pacing myself for a long marathon. And so for those who have expected me to have had a fire in my bones, to have led the charge as I once did, and have been disappointed, all I can say is that I am disappointed too. I need to push myself and try to work my way out of this malaise that I've been in for some time. My involvement in this battle began on the 10th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, 1983. My intent is to inch my way back into this more this year, which is the 40th anniversary. At least I plan to do more than I have, and to push myself to do more, and to call our church body to do more as well. Though admittedly, I'm not sure yet what it is exactly that I will be calling on everyone to do. Would a rescue be out of the question? It's supposed to be funny. You guys are a little horrified. There is no way I'm going to organize a rescue. Although I think you guys would be easier to manage than the folks I had years ago. Last night, I sent Kathy Humbarger an email that I will probably regret. I told her that she had her permission to pester me if I or our church could be of help. And up to this time, my standard response to her had always been no, and so she eventually quit trying. So however this works out, I think it is safe to say that I probably won't drive you crazy with all this as I did my first church, because the key words here is I'm inching my way back, and it's going to be slow. But we need to be more involved. We need to do more. We need to get that oar in the water, and we really need to work and keep plugging away at this. For all of us, wherever you are at in this, whether you're in season or out of season on this, for all of us, we need to be in season. If we believe abortion is murder, we need to act like it, and we have to push if we have to push ourselves now and then to act like it, then so be it. All right, I'm well over time. I need to ring the Sunday school bell. And sorry I didn't have any cool graphics this morning. Maybe next Sunday. Speaking of next Sunday, we're going to do something quite a bit different. The plan is to talk about the book of Proverbs, so it may be helpful if you could memorize a few of those chapters between now and then. That would be a great advantage. You got a whole week. All right, let's bring in the children once they get ready, and if the musicians can come, and let's stand and we'll continue our time of corporate worship.